Now, tonight we're going to be talking about a very scary case that turned into a book called The Black Monk of Pontefract. It is, quite frankly, it's one of the most scariest poltergeist cases that anybody's ever come across. Two special guests will be joining us in a moment. Richard Estep back with us, and Bill Bungay will be joining us to talk about this incredible story. Stand by. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our two special guests tonight. First of all, Richard Estep back with us. He was last with me about a year ago. First got involved with paranormal research in 1995 in the United Kingdom after attending an overnight investigation at the very infamous church out there. And he spent the next 5 years investigating the haunted hamlets of Great Britain. He co-founded the Boulder County Paranormal Research Group in Colorado with his wife, Laura, after relocating to the United States back in 1999. Richard, welcome back. I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you, George, for having me back, and it's a pleasure to be here.
This is going to be exciting. And then Bill Bungay is with us. He's a movie maker. Some of his movies include When the Lights Went Out, Nuriev, Maradona, and the Parapod movie. He is an ad man. He founded a BMB, which is a top 10 London, England advertising agency. That's pretty good. A published singer-songwriter, owner of the most haunted house in the United Kingdom, which we'll talk about. And Bill was a skeptic, but the house changed all of that, resulting him in co-authoring the book with Richard, called, of course, The Black Monk of Pontefract. And Bill, welcome to the program as well.
Good evening, George. Good evening, Richard. And good evening to all my American cousins.
How did you two guys come across this incredible story of the Black Monk of Pontefract? Let's start with you, Richard.
Well, this was a story that I'd always grown up with, Jordan. As a young kid, before there were any paranormal TV shows, I would read every book that I could on the subject from both sides of the Atlantic. And one of the classics of the genre was Poltergeist by Colin Wilson, a very ubiquitous author. And the story of the Black Monk, I remember, frightening me from a very early age, because he had all of the components here of a terrifying haunting. You had this tall, dark, hooded figure which menaced a family. And the key thing, I think, was this didn't take place in some old manor house or historic castle. I saw pictures of the house, and this was the kind of place that I lived in, you know? It could have happened in your house or my house, and that's when I think it becomes most frightening.
Indeed. And Bill, let's bring you in. You own the house where this ghost poltergeist happens to be. How did you end up finding this house?
I do indeed, George, and it's interestingly, but via the same route as Richard. In fact, Colin Wilson's book Poltergeist was given to me a good 30 years ago by a work colleague of mine, whose mother had witnessed the events directly, the events that happened back in the 70s, and I ended up I thought that it was such an interesting story. The idea that a poltergeist moves into a small, we call them council houses in the UK. It's just like a state assisted home. I just thought it was a fascinating storyline. Poltergeist moves into council house because, as Richard says, you know, they're normally sort of associated with you know, big castles or dark mansion houses. But this one moved into a tiny home. And I thought, what a great idea for a movie. So really all I did was set about making a movie about the house, but as a skeptic, and subsequently having made the movie, I was looking, being an ad man, I was looking for an interesting way to promote the movie, and it just so happened that one of my clients was in Pontefract in West Yorkshire, which is in the north of England, and I went over to the house, and there it was for the first time. I was, you know, visiting this infamous home, and then I noticed the for sale sign, and discovered that it had been on the market for 4 years. It was sat empty, damp, rotting away, basically. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, I could have my premiere in the actual house, you know, the movie about the house in the actual house. And so I bought it, thinking that I would do just that, and I did. I had a tiny little red carpet put down this small pavement, and two competition winners walked down the red carpet, were led into the house, and they sat and watched the movie. Sadly, nothing of any great merit occurred that night, which was my suspicion. I was a skeptic at the time. And sadly, my brilliant idea fell on deaf ears and barely created a whisper in the media. So I was, it didn't go to plan. But as I say, I was a skeptic. So all I felt that I needed to do then was to, repair the house, do it up, and I was going to sell it. But then strange things started to happen that I'm sure we'll get into. So that's how I ended up owning the house.
So you didn't know it was haunted prior to buying it, did you?
Well, I certainly didn't believe that it was haunted because, I've got a great deal of respect for skeptics, and rest assured, I am not in the business of trying to convince anyone that's skeptical to believe, in the paranormal. I was resolutely skeptical when I bought the house. And so, I absolutely didn't believe that it was haunted at the time because I didn't really believe in ghosts.
Do you still own it, Richard? Bill?
I do, yeah. I mean, as a direct consequence in fact, people started to ask, as soon as they found out that I owned the house, they started contacting me to say, would you mind if I go into the house to investigate? And frankly, I thought these people were a bit odd, but I said, well, fine, if you can give me, a few quid to pay for the council tax, help yourselves.
Sure.
But then they started to, started reporting back to me. I started getting all these emails. I ended up getting photographs that were absolutely extraordinary. Obviously being an ad man, my specialism is as an art director. So, I have to, put my cards on the table and say, if there's anyone that's capable of faking a picture or a video, it would be me. But as a consequence, I can look at pictures and videos and know with a high degree of certainty whether they have been faked or not, because I can study them. I know the amount of detail, attention to detail, equipment, casting, makeup, all of the things that you could ordinarily, try and accuse an image of having mustard in order to be created. I can look at those pictures and I can make a fairly certain, a very clear assessment of whether or not they've been faked. And occasionally we get, sort of pareidolia images and the like that are very obviously, just pareidolia and nothing
right.
more. But I started to get all these pictures and videos as well. And I knew, instinctively knew that they weren't faked, at which point my sort of spider senses started tingling. And I've sort of ended up building a website at 30eastdrive.com, 30eastdrive.com. And now people visit regularly. In fact, there's people in there every single night of the week, and it regularly gets a five-star review on Google and so on and so forth. So I still have the house because now I know, emphatically know, that there is something extremely unique about the place, and that there is, there are phenomena occurring in that house that are, beyond rational explanation.
And Richard, tell us who is the Black Monk of Pontefract?
Well, there's the commonly accepted story, and then there's what we think is really the case. The commonly accepted story, it's more of an urban legend, which sprang up right around the time of the case itself. And the story goes that there was a monk who was quite a devious and nasty character, supposedly had sexually assaulted a young girl in that area, and once he had been caught by the locals, had been strung up, and depending on which version of the story you hear,
may have been thrown down a well, or the girl's body may have been thrown down the well. There are several variations on this theme. And so it kind of persisted for many years, but when you dig into the history of the area, 30 East Drive is built on a battlefield.
Uh-huh.
And although there were indeed monks in that area, there's not a shred of evidence to support this idea of a criminal, you know, foul kind of character, as the black monk was supposed to be. So as Bill and I talked to more people, we did our research, did some investigation, we began to form an entirely different conclusion, which hopefully we'll talk about as the interview goes on.
Absolutely. Now, isn't there a well under that house at 30 East Drive?
You know, there is a well under the house at 30 East Drive. At least we have eyewitnesses that say it's there. Call Bill old-fashioned. He doesn't really want to dig up the living room of the house. And also, the house adjoins another house, so it's directly connected, kind of like a duplex here in the States. So somebody lives on the other side of that wall as well, and they experience paranormal phenomena on a regular basis, too. But we do have eyewitnesses that many, many years ago, as children, saw that well with their own eyes. So at least that part of the story seems to have a basis in fact.
Might that well be where they dumped the body of the monk?
I don't believe that for a minute, because who in their right mind, if you're a villager, who destroys their own water supply?
Right.
By dumping a body.
Exactly.
It makes no sense.
Especially with that kind of a body.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great story, isn't it? But a story is all that we believe it is.
When did you decide to write the book with Bill?
Well, I'd always wanted to visit 30 East Drive. It was one of my bucket list locations. And I'm fortunate enough that I get to travel across the U.S. and the U.K. and make several trips like this each year. And I'd always wanted to see where the story went after Colin Wilson stopped telling it. And like most people, I just assumed it had petered out. But when the movie came out, there was this massive resurgence of interest in 30 East Drive. And other paranormal investigators, guys like Andy Evans, had gone and found that the house was still paranormally active. And so I contacted Bill, and I said, I would love to come research this for myself. Now, I'm always very, very wary when somebody has something to gain from a paranormal project.
And sure.
I hadn't met Bill in person, and as he says, he's an ad man, so he kind of had a vested interest in good publicity for his house. But to his credit, he never asked me for a dime, and he turned over the keys to his property and said, you know, it's yours for 5 days. Just write what you find. So if you get nothing, write nothing. But if something happens, I would like you to tell the story honestly, which is, you know, music to the ears of any writer. And so Bill is really the expert on the most recent happenings at 30 East Drive, and I realized that I needed his expertise and mm-hmm. his experiences there to truly make it a fleshed out account of what was going on. And it seemed like a natural partnership. And once I determined that Bill's integrity was beyond question, I was really happy to start working with him.
Great. Now, Richard, have you ever spent the night in that house?
Oh, yeah, five of them.
You stayed there for the five nights, and would you ever go back again?
You know, I would, but it's a strange house. It frightens me, but not for the reason you might think. George, I'm a child of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill has, I think in a rather bold move, he has the house decorated as it would have been during the 1960s and 70s.
It hasn't changed at all.
Well, he's gone to great lengths to evoke that atmosphere.
Yeah.
So you walk into the house, and for me, I'm instantly 5 years old again, because it looks exactly like my grandmother's house at that time. It's genuinely creepy. And I found that actually caused me a few challenges, if you know what I mean.
I bet.
I was never very comfortable closing my eyes in that house. And, you know, to be rational, I mean, I'd been preloaded with 40 years' worth of stories about the Black Monk. So you have to realize your own psyche is working against you in cases like this. But we worked through the night. We researched through the night. There were some nights when nothing happened at all of note. And there were other days and nights when the strangest things occurred. So the house will surprise you. It doesn't perform on cue. You know, you can't walk into that house for 4 hours and guarantee that something will happen. But if you put in the time, it will reward you. Usually
we'll,
not in the way that you'll think.
We'll get into some of those episodes that might have occurred there. Now, how about you, Bill? Have you spent the night in your own house? I hear you might not have.
Absolutely no way, George. absolutely no way. The place, of course, it intrigues me, But in the same breath, it absolutely terrifies me. It's the unseen, George. So it's, you know, we know that there's something in there. It can see you. You can't see it, or for the best part, you can't see it. So, you know, what's interesting, we might come back to this, but I used to have a recurring nightmare when I was a kid. For several years, I had this nightmare where I would go upstairs into this cold, sort of dark house, and in the top room of this house, there was a room, and inside that room, it was a completely black and dark room, no light. There was a presence, mm-hmm. and it would taunt me regularly. It would taunt me, and I would wake up screaming. It took me years to get over it. And for me, it's somewhat ironic that I should end up owning the house in which, you know, a presence of that ilk resides. So for me, I have an extra kind of sort of fear factor, and that is the fact that this is, you know, representative or a real version of a recurring nightmare for me. It absolutely terrifies me, George.
And when you're in the house and when it starts getting dark, Bill, what do? Just get out of there?
Well, I've only ever been in the house on my own a couple of times, and believe it or not, both of those occasions, some oddness has occurred. So I will only ever really be in that house when there's other people. And I have been in there after hours, but as I say, there's always been lots of other people. So there's been busyness, things, you know, there's always been noise and things that would, give me a degree of comfort. But there's absolutely no way I'm about to spend any time, you know, in that house alone. And I have a great deal of respect for visitors like Richard who are prepared to go and, you know, spend, you know, sleep upstairs.
Right.
Imagine that.
I'm not sure I could do that either. That's...
Well,
my gosh.
No.
Go
if
ahead.
I could ask you, the first time that Bill and I met was at the front door of the house, and I'd flown 5,000 miles to meet Bill, amongst other things, and the first thing he did when he stepped inside the house was talk to Ghost. And he looked up, you know, as if he's kind of addressing the sky, and he said, "Hey, it's me, it's Bill. Listen, okay, I'm here respectfully. I'm just here to show Richard around, give him the keys, okay?" And he was talking as you would to someone you really don't want to upset. You know, somebody that you're frightened of? It was genuine fear. And then the following day, my brother Matthew came to visit. My brother and I, we rarely see each other because he's a sergeant in the British Infantry. Matthew came to the house with my nephew and my niece and wasn't going to come inside, but they bullied him into it. And so he came inside for 10 minutes, and my brother has served in multiple combat zones. You know, he's the brave and the good-looking one in our family. He was like a cat on a hot tin roof. He walked through the house. He looked around. He said, "I don't know how you're going to spend the night here, bruv. There's something in this house, and it's
evil." Jeez, he felt it.
Yeah, and understand, too, my brother is about as down-to-earth as they come. He's not fanciful. You know, he doesn't, I think, get all of the paranormal stuff that I do. I'm the strange one in the family. But he felt something in that house. And he was out in 10 minutes and does not want to come back.
I guess you can't blame him.
Not really.
All right, stay with us, you two. We're going to take a quick break, but we will come back and talk more about your work, The Black Monk of Pontefract. It's a scary situation. Richard has several other books out there, and his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll talk more with him and Bill about this situation and some of the work that they've both been doing. That's scary. I'm not sure I would spend the night in that house either. I don't blame Bill at all. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, with our two special guests, Richard Estep and Bill Bungay. And the website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about their work that they wrote together called The Black Monk of Pontefract. Bill, how close is East Yorkshire to London, for example?
It's actually West Yorkshire, George, but it's about a 3.5-hour train journey, so it's right in the middle of the United Kingdom.
Okay, that's a pretty good poke, though.
It is, yes, yeah. And the interesting thing about the area is, you know, in relation to 30 East Drive, is the fact that it is right in the middle of the country, and I mean right in the middle, so north to south and east to west. If you were to sort of, you know, cross the country, you would end up roughly on Pontefract. It's uncannily kind of in the middle of nowhere, actually.
And Richard, when you spent the 5 nights in this house, what happened?
Well, the first thing that happened, the house kind of took me off guard. So we met Bill at the door, and Bill and I had wanted to do what most British people want to do when they meet, and that's go to the pub and get some lunch. So there was no alcohol for me, but Bill could have a pint, and so we went and locked the house up. But before we did, I was kind of sneaky, and remember I'd mentioned earlier on that I wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing anything, you know, that I wasn't being led up the garden path. So I'd placed a digital voice recorder at the top of the staircase to record sounds in the house when we were out. So we were gone for an hour, had some lunch, came back, walked into the house, and at the bottom of the stairs was a mirror that had hung on the wall there for many years, and it was smashed into numerous pieces laying at the foot of the stairs.
Hmm.
And being the cynical 25-year paranormal investigator that I am, I'm like, I know what happened. This guy, sorry for this, Bill, I keep telling this story. I thought this guy has had one of his friends come in, perhaps, and, you know, given them a spare key, and they've decided to put on a spectacle for the writer that came over from America. But he doesn't know that I've left the voice recorder running.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I made my excuses. I went upstairs and threw on my headphones, and I listened to the audio, and I'm fully expecting to hear the sound of a door opening, of footsteps coming into the house, and there was nothing on that recording other than the sound of this almighty smash. So, just to make sure, we took it in turns to try and open the door as quietly as we could and sneak in while we recorded it to see if it was possible to silently move through that house. Now, it's an old house, and as Bill said, council houses, as they're called, were not the most robustly constructed. You know,
right.
They were cheap, and they're very, very noisy. And it was impossible to move across that floor and to get a door open to gain access to the house without making some kind of noise, no matter how many times we tried.
Mm-hmm.
We even tried belly crawling in order to get there and do it, and we couldn't do it.
That still made a sound, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah.
So I'd been in the house literally 5 minutes, had locked the place up tight, and that was my welcome to the Black Monk House, to 30 East Drive.
Did you ever feel that your life was in danger or anything like that?
No. I know that there's a lot of drama, and I say that as someone who does, you know, TV shows where things are perhaps played up like that sometimes. But in reality, whatever there is at 30 East Drive, it is not beyond injuring people. It injured my colleague Charlie, in fact. Charlie was standing at the sink while the rest of us were getting some food in the dining room. So we were watching him at the time. He was in plain view of us, and he said, you know, my back is burning. And I didn't really pay much attention to him at first. He said, no, seriously, my back's burning, and something has hold of my ankles. So he felt as if a pair of hands had grabbed
his
ankles. So I whipped out my thermal camera rather than rush straight over to him and started taking pictures, images of his back. And Charlie developed a series of very deep, very long scratches that were going across the small of his back.
That's interesting. Did you sense evil in that house, Richard?
I'm one of those people, George, that doesn't sense much of anything. You know, it's in Valentine's Day today, isn't it?
That's right.
Barely remembering to sense how annoyed my wife will be if I don't pick something.
We got to get that going.
Yeah, we do. So I'm not one of those sense people, but even I do feel odd in that house. But you know, for me, as I mentioned earlier, it's the fact that the house looks like a time capsule from the 1970s, and I'd heard so much about it. Another of my colleagues, though, Leslie, I brought her in for the last night in the house. She'd never been there before. She's a very down-to-earth lady. She walked into the house, and within 5 minutes, she made her excuses, and she was vomiting.
Vomiting? My gosh.
Vomiting.
Other than being sick, what would cause that? Something within the atmosphere there.
Well, the logical thing is food poisoning, except she and I had eaten the same thing.
You would have gotten sick, too.
Well, you would think. And she said, can you not feel the atmosphere in here? The atmosphere is just so heavy and oppressive.
And, you know, I think that once you say that, it becomes kind of a matter of suggestion, so it's not really a valid test. But it affected her enough. And I've been on a number of paranormal investigations with Leslie. I've never seen her vomit before. So it affected her very quickly and very immediately. Yeah, I mean, immediately.
Bill, what do people say about the house when they go there?
Oh, gosh. A number of responses, not excluding Richard's response. That's really not unusual. I think the impression that I have is that, generally speaking, people go there and they have one of two experiences. The first is that they go in there and it just feels like an ordinary home. We use the term it's feast or famine in that house. And on occasion, people will go there and it'll be famine. But the net result of that is that they end up in a really warm, you know, as Richard suggested, you know, your grandmother's house. And you can feel quite safe. And on other occasions, you'll go in there and you will feel this oppressive environment. And it's really not unusual. Often female guests will feel nauseous. In fact, I had a film crew in there a few months ago, and the young female producer looked very unwell while she was there. Mm-hmm. And eventually I sort of said, you know, what, are you feeling okay? She says, no, I've been throwing up, and I thought that was unusual. And actually, I hadn't remembered what had happened to Richard's producer. So it's interesting that, and also as soon as people leave the house, you know, within minutes of leaving the house, they suddenly feel
better
again.
Do they end up coming back to the house for a second or third trip?
Well, it depends on the individuals, but we get a lot of repeat visits. I mean, a lot. So, you know, very often people go there, they have experiences, and then they're, you know, ready and willing to go back to try and dig a little deeper. And in fact, what's also worth mentioning is the people that go, I don't think of them as visitors, actually. I think of them as investigators.
Okay.
These are people that are really quite serious about trying to, you know, trying to ascertain, you know, what it is, to capture evidence. And so they come, very, with a very kind of professional view of things and often get results as well.
What did they say generally when they leave the house, Bill?
Well, I think the best way of expressing what they say is in the form of the things that they capture. Because when someone sends you a story or a picture or a video, it's often accompanied by, a kind of a sense of exasperation. You know, I've captured this, what is it? And so I think for the best part, people leave with a massive question mark. And that question mark is one, I think it's one that's related to, you know, to a bigger theme, which is, you know, the grand scheme of everything. And so I think that people are now going there not just to capture a ghost, per se, but to try and understand just exactly what is the nature of things. And as I, you know, as I now feel with regards to the house, I haven't bought a haunted house. What I've bought is a potential experiment. A subject that may help us understand, you know, the grand scheme of things. Such is its significance. I think it's too easy for us just to drop into, well, it's a ghost, and not question, you know, what a ghost is, if indeed it is a ghost. So now I think people are going with a much more open view as to what the nature of things are, and they're hoping that the house will present them with some clues as to the nature of things.
You ban Ouija
the other
boards.
Thing, George, is that people seem to feel compelled to go back to this house. I heard that quite often as I was interviewing witnesses. Bill, are you still hearing that people feel as if they're drawn back multiple times?
Like pulled back like a magnet.
Yeah.
Most definitely, Richard, and obviously self included. There is something definitely something, you know, that draws you back there. Once you've engaged with the house, you feel compelled to return, which is, you know, profound in its own right.
You have banned Ouija boards and exorcisms from the house, Bill. And not a bad idea, but why have you done that?
Firstly, on the subject of Ouija boards, we have sort of anecdotal evidence to suggest that it may well be that there was a connection between the spirit or, you know, or spirits and the use of Ouija board. It's a theory, but obviously back in the 70s, there wasn't really much in the way of kind of, you know, digital, well, there wasn't any digital entertainment, but, you know, if you had a TV, you were lucky. And so you needed to make your own entertainment, and Ouija boards were a thing, you know, back in the day. And so we think it's plausible that particularly the son that lived in the house, Philip Pritchard, the family were called the Pritchards, he may potentially have used a Ouija board in there. We have no proof of that. But we're also aware of the fact that Ouija boards, you know, if they're not used properly, can result in all sorts of you know, things occurring that you wouldn't want in your home. So with Ouija boards, we don't want to exacerbate the situation. It's already, you know, very active in that house. On the subject of, sorry, what was the other question on?
The Ouija boards, of course, that was one thing, and also the exorcisms.
Oh, exorcisms, sorry. Yes. And so exorcisms, historically, what we've discovered in Colin Wilson's book, there's talk of exorcisms, and in fact, we represent the exorcism in When the Lights Went Out, the movie When the Lights Went Out. And the interesting thing about that is that they don't work on poltergeists. So there's really no point in us attempting to exorcise the spirits. They don't work. There's been several exorcisms in that house, and it stays there. And lastly, I don't know why we would want to clear the house, because it offers us, as I say, potentially offers us some real insight into the grand scheme of things. So, you know, we want it to stay as it is for the purposes of study.
Sure. Richard, do you think it is that monk that was killed?
I don't think a monk was ever killed there. I think it was a big urban legend,
myth,
a tale that grew in the telling.
Interesting. Now, the Pritchard... Well, go ahead, Bill.
If I may, just a quick one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the well story is interesting, and Richard's right. There is no proof to support the hypothesis. But what is interesting is during our research, we discovered that there's actually a line of wells across the sort of top of the house is on a hill. And across the top of the hill, we discovered that there's actually a series of wells. And they're almost sunk, equidistant. And what's interesting is the wells go, you know, you've got one well, and then, you know, 50 meters later, there's another, 50 meters later, there's another one. 50 meters later, there's a gap. And then 50 meters later, there's another well, which is interesting, because if you follow the hypothesis that the well was poisoned, you would then probably cap it and ignore it, because there are other wells in the area. So it's one of those that we can't prove that bodies were ever thrown down the well, but it is interesting that there's this sort of equidistant sinking of wells, and there's one that's missing directly where East Drive is.
Now, Richard, was the monk killed regardless of where it might have been, but was he arrested for the situation at hand and then killed by the crowd?
No, there's not a shred of evidence that ever happened.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, you know, a good logical question then would be, and I'm sure your listeners are thinking this, why on earth would you call your book The Black...
That was my next question.
Yeah, perfect. Absolutely. So I'm sure that you and many of your listeners are familiar with the concept of thought forms. Now, Bill and I devoted the last significant section of our book to some possible explanations for what could be happening at 30 East Drive. But there's no doubt that many people have seen a black monk there. And even captured a black monk-like shape on photographs.
Right.
A terrific one was captured coming down the stairs at 30 East Drive. It's my opinion, and I'm sure Bill will be able to give his in just a moment, but my opinion is that the tale has been told so many times of the black monk that we've given him reality, that the equivalent of a thought form has been created at this house.
And he's manifested because of
that? And the constant stream of visitors, as Bill said, there are people are in there every night, and that what he has is not a haunted house so much as an ongoing paranormal experiment. As people try and interact, as they expect to see this monk, they're essentially creating him and keeping him going.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about this incredible story, the Black Monk of Pontefract, if he exists, and then we'll take phone calls as well. Also, Bill, I want to ask you when we come back about the original people who were in the house in 1966, the Pritchards, and the things that happened to them.